Position number 21560, Reel 2.
John Gritton, Reel 2.
Up to then, I'd been in number one boiler room with a Stoker Pity officer called Cock Kent. The roster was changed about a week or 10 days before, and I was actually on watch in number three boiler room, which was the boiler which was furthest aft. So round about, I suppose it must have been about 10 to 2 in the afternoon, we started firing. We just caught up with a convoy, and it was, although it had been going full steam in order to catch up, we were now closing down number one boiler room in order to go presumably at the speed of the convoy. And just as we were doing this, the gun started firing, and it was obvious that we were under attack again. There was then a very loud crump. It wasn't... I don't know how to explain it. It actually shook the ship, and at the same time, all the lights went out. My Stoker Petty officer jumped up the ladder and through the hatch at the top. I was in darkness, and I had to try and think what the last order was. The last order was to turn on the sprayers in order to maintain speed. No, sorry, it was the opposite. It was to turn off the sprayers. These are the oil fuel sprayers into the furnace, to turn them off, or else we would be making too much steam and the safety valve would blow. So I was doing this in the dark, and God knows whether I was doing the right thing or not, but I was... then the hatch above opened, and the Stoker Petty officer shouted down, "For Christ's sake, come up, we've been hit." And so I went up the ladder. On the upper deck, it seemed to be a lot of confusion, a lot of men running hither and thither. And at one stage, the whaler was being manned. And then the order came from somebody on the bridge, probably Vine, I don't know. "Why are you doing that? The Griffin, of which is another destroyer, is coming alongside, and so of course the whaler should not be lowered." Next thing I remember is one of the Stoker Petty officers dealing out the life jackets, the neck breakers as we call them, and I was given one and put it on, but I already had my Mae West on, which is, as you probably know, is the thing you blow up and you have on permanently. And we took on board at Namsos 30 soldiers. They were the members of the Hallamshire Battalion of the York and Lancaster Regiment. 13 of these actually were killed when we were hit. But one of the soldiers who was okay, another thing I've forgotten to say is that whether it was due to me not doing the turning off enough sprayers or not, I don't know, but the safety valve lifted and there was this siren going off which drowned all other noise. So a soldier came up to me and he pointed at my two life jackets and pointed to himself, more or less gesticulating to say that I've got none. Could he have the life jacket? So I gave him. And I always remember this because the same Stoker Petty officer who had given it me minutes before saw me without one. They must have thought I was crazy. Anyhow, she was listing forward and to port. We had actually been hit by two bombs, both on the port side. One had ripped a hole right at the side of the wireless telegraphy office and number one boiler room underneath. And there was an absolute miraculous escape of the Stoker Petty officer, who was called Lofty Coombs, in that boiler room. All the men down on the plates were killed outright. Lofty had gone up on in order to turn off the safety valve on the top of the big steam drum, because, I say, the orders had been given to close down number one boiler room. And when the bomb ripped up the side, the water must have rushed in and carried him over to one side of the ship. And although blinded, temporarily, as I discovered later, he got his sight back, he swam across the boiler room to where he could see the light where the bomb had ripped open, and somebody leant over the side and actually pulled him up. I learned all this afterwards. I actually helped him along the deck to the one of the two destroyers, actually to the Imperial. Both the Imperial and the Griffin came alongside, the Imperial to the port side and the Griffin to the starboard. And I helped him, and he was an extraordinary chap. He always had a smile on his face. Long, lanky, long hair, most unpuzzle-like. And in spite of the fact that he was blinded and black and so on, he was still smiling, and obviously he was hurt. But he was walking, and I and another chap helped him along. All the members of the Stokers, all the Stokers on the Stokers mess deck were killed, and most of those on the Seaman's desk, actually all of them on the Seaman's mess deck, including the soldiers who had been there, as I say, it was a total of 13, were killed. We also, from the Bisson, had picked up a total of 69 survivors from the Bisson. Of them, 30-odd were killed, about 35, I think, were killed. So the other chap I remember helping across, who used to be in the Stoker's mess, was the Stoker, the engineer's writer. He kept on saying, "It's all right, there are others worse than I am," and he didn't need help, but anyhow, we helped him along the deck onto one of the ships. The next thing I remember is helping some of the Frenchmen who were wounded and lying on the wardroom floor, because it was the only place in the ship which had any kind of soft covering. It had a carpet, and they were wounded, were lying on the floor. And I and others helped them across the gangway onto the Imperial. And I think I must have probably crossed at least two times, possibly three, but certainly two times, back onto the Freedom, back onto the Imperial, carrying these very wounded men. Oh, plus two of our own very, very badly wounded Stokers who later died. I then went on to the starboard side, and I saw Viam and there was a chief yeoman of signals who was trying to persuade Vian to leave the ship. And Vian was telling him, "You go, you know, I'm obviously being the captain," he wanted to be the last to leave the ship. So the yeoman of signals left, and the last I saw Vian was striding in his duffel coat aft, and he went on to the Imperial. Cock Kent, who used to be the stoker petty officer that I did most of my watches with, he was already on the Griffin, which was the level was quite, he said, "Quick, jump off," and so I jumped onto the Griffin. So when people say, how long did you spend in the icy waters, I always have to tell them that I never even got my feet wet. It was 45 minutes, I think, since she was hit that the Afridi actually went down. The Griffin had a whole, she had survivors from at least one of the anti-submarine trawlers, survivors from the Bison, and our survivors on board, as well as her own complement. And so there are a whole number of wounded actually lying on the deck. And as she was swaying, I thought they would, you know, they would slip over, so I tried to hold on to one chap in particular, a Frenchman, who was obviously in a very bad way. They went, most of them went, moved undercover until evening. I don't know, it was about 3 o'clock, I think, in the afternoon that I heard another plane, well, guns from a far-off destroyer, which was almost certainly the Imperius, opening up on an attacking plane, or planes. And so I heard this coming. I was looking after this Frenchman, and I remember, I don't know whether you know what a gas chute is, but it's the chute which you throw all the rubbish into the sea. And I remember diving under the gas chute as this plane dived. They were all Junkers dive bombers, incidentally, Stukas. I distinctly remember one of our own Afridi seamen manning one of the pom-poms above me and firing at this plane. And I never met him before, because this engine room branch doesn't have much liaison with the upper deck ratings. So I really didn't know him, but I always remember, and I can see his face there. Naturally, we didn't bring this plane down. Well, to cut a long story short, we eventually got back to the Shetlands. The wounded were transferred to a French hospital ship, and we eventually, via Greenock, got back. We disembarked at Greenock, and that was it, as far as I'm concerned.
What happened to you after this?
Went to Pompey Barracks, and I was then given a draft chit to Hull, to the Humber boiler, permanent boiler cleaning party. And for the next 2.5 to 3 years, I was cleaning the boilers of destroyers.
Whereabouts in Hull?
We were billeted on the Church Army Mission, which was a converted convent called the Etheldreda Mission, which was near the bridge over the River Hull. I think it's George Street, the top of George Street. It was actually run by the Church Army, and this was a complete revelation to me to be, for the first time, not under naval discipline. There were no petty officers. There were a few old boys supping tea and smoking their briars on the ground floor, looked after by the Church Army. Then there were the us boiler cleaner cleaning stokers, and above us were a few seamen who served in HMS Beaver 2, I think they call it, Stone Frigate, which was the headquarters in Hull, naval headquarters. The amusing thing was that being a convent, each of us had cabins, and on the each cabin it had a brass plate with Sister Mary or Sister Agatha or whatever it was on the door, and you can imagine the language which went on, which was exchanged, and I should think the nuns must have got risen from their graves to have heard us. The grub was appalling, because of course the men in the armed forces, especially in the Navy, were very well fed compared with the poor civilians, the rationed civilians during the war. But for some reason or other, we were fed at night after working all day in the boilers on baked beans, and that had to last until the next morning, and so on and so on.
So you didn't get enough food?
No, the food was appalling, and we kept on complaining, but it never got better.
What did your job involve?
Boiler cleaning was roughly in in two sections. It was what was called the external, which meant that you climbed up inside the funnel, and with a wire scrubber, you scrubbed the soot, the oil fuel soot, down from inside the funnel. You then had what was called a saw, and you sawed between the hundreds of steam tubes which carried the boiling water through these tubes up to the upper drum. The boilers consisted of one very large drum at the top and two drums on each side, port and starboard, and these were connected with the tubes, and the furnace was underneath with the oil fuel sprayers jetting the oil into the furnace. So these had to be cleaned. They should have been cleaned, I think, every 900 hours, but in wartime and with the terrific imposition on the destroyers, very often they went after longer, 1,000 hours and more. Anyhow, the boilers had to be cleaned. So after you got the soot from in between the tubes, there was then a forced air, what do you call it, hydraulic air, which you blew, and the whole boiler room then became a mass of oil fuel soot. And of course you weren't given any masks, you just put a rag over your face, and for days afterwards we would be wheezing. The other thing was called the internal part, and you had to climb inside the drums, the steel drums, and you couldn't sit up. You had to lie on your back, and again with a scrubber, you had to scrub the inside of the steel inside of the drums. You then had to paint them with what was called plumbago, which was black lead, like mums used to do the fire grate with. That had then, after it dried, had to be polished, which meant all the black lead or plumbago fell on your face, and again it got in your chest. This was all right. These permanent boiler cleaning parties consisted, I should think, about 85% to 90% of RNR men who'd retired and who'd been brought back into the service. So there were men in their 50s at least. To me, as a youngster of 21, they seemed extremely old. Lot of them in very poor health, and one of them particularly, I remember, had one lung. So this was a particularly arduous job for these elderly stokers. That was roughly the job. I did it, but sometimes we went over to Grimsby and did the destroyers which came in there, sometimes into Immingham. In Immingham they actually had a naval base there, and for a time I was there also.
Where were the destroyers docked in Hull that you were working on?
King George and King Albert. The Albert dock. The Albert dock and the King George.
What was the atmosphere like in Hull during that period you were there?
Herbert Morrison said that, I think he said it after the war or maybe during the war, he said that Hull was the provincial city which suffered more bombing raids than any other provincial city. Indeed, from the time I went there in May 1940, there were raids practically every night, but they weren't serious. Only one or two were fairly heavy, until the night of the two very big blitzes. Up to then, people obviously complained. I mean, the civilians actually complained, and it meant that all the pubs had to, as soon as the air raid warnings went, the sirens went, all the pubs had to clear out, and everybody had to go into the air raid shelters. Until the big blitz, it was, I think most civilians found it quite bearable. I can't remember the actual date, whether it was the 14th and 15th of May, I forget the actual dates. That particular night, I was going ashore. We called it going ashore, which of course is the usual business, even if you step out of a Church Army hostel. And there, in Queen's Gardens, they had, by the Wilberforce Monument, as it was then, there were dugouts, which I think had been made either in 1938 or during the Munich crisis. Nobody went into them, but as soon as this heavy raid started, bombs started dropping straight away, I dived into this dugout, and there was not a soul there. And I always maintain that this was the most frightening night, or the most frightening experience of the whole war. in spite of various bombings at sea and all the rest of it, I was really very, very frightened, probably because I was on my own. If you're with other people, you have to show face. And anyhow, that was the first. I felt that every bomb was coming directly for me. The second night was just as heavy, but I went into another air raid shelter with a whole number of civilians, and it wasn't half so scary. As far as the civilian population were concerned, it was undoubtedly, they then started going en masse, at least nightly, into, I think, Cottingham and various places outside of Hull. As I say, I don't know, some of them may have stayed there for some nights and others just went out every evening. But it certainly had quite a serious effect on morale. If they'd kept it up, God knows what it would have been.
Did you come across individuals who showed signs of having cracked or cracking?
No. I had a girlfriend whom I eventually married. She was in Lee Smith Street, which was off near the George, up the other end of Hedden Road. Lee Smith Street was bombed. Her house was not directly hit, but she spent, I remember seeing her absolutely covered in soot and mess as she was trying to clear up her home. And she lived with her foster parents. And obviously they were very badly shaken, but no, I didn't see any proper signs of real demoralization.
Anybody who felt that the war ought to be brought to an end because of it?
No.
What do you remember about any specific destruction in Hull in the Blitz? Any particular streets or buildings?
Well, I remember I helped clearing rubble. I can't remember the details. All that I can remember is that I ruined my tiddly suit, and I put in for a new tiddly uniform, because I was helping to get the wreckage away. Cinemas which I'd been in were destroyed. There were huge holes in the road. And one thing is that we were asked for volunteers of the UU and U variety to dig out a hole in the King George dock. The army had already shored it up, but we had to go down. It was all this kind of very wet clay, and this was an unexploded bomb. And for a day or two, we were filling up buckets which were hauled up and emptied somewhere or other. So we did a bit of that as well. I can't remember any other specific demolition.
Where did you go for places of entertainment in Hull?
Oh, cinema. Different cinemas. There's practically nowhere to eat. There was one place, just one place, in Annaby Road. I forget what they call it, lagoon, the Blue Lagoon. And that was the only place where you could get a snack after the pubs closed. There were two notorious pubs, the Neptune and the Paragon, one opposite the other. And the